New Millennium Audio presents Life Beyond Earth, written and read by Timothy Ferris. Preface. People have been speculating about life beyond Earth since the dawn of history. What's new is that we have now begun to acquire the tools necessary to replace some of these speculations with fact. Humans have collected rocks on the surface of the moon, sent instrumental probes to the planets, employed large telescopes on the ground and in orbit to study the stars, and explored the Earth to investigate how life here began and evolved. So far, the results of the search for extraterrestrial life have been negative. The moon, long portrayed in hoax and hopeful speculation as inhabited, is lifeless. Venus turned out to be fearfully hot and dry, a disappointment for those who envision tropical jungles hidden beneath its perpetual clouds. Space probes dispatched to Mars have found no clear evidence of biological activity, although it may take decades of further study to determine whether there is, or once was, life on Mars. Meanwhile, other avenues of research have opened new vistas onto the subject of extraterrestrial life and the related issue of how life began. Here on Earth, living organisms have been found thriving in hot vents in the dark depths of the sea, in frigid Antarctic waters, in core samples drilled miles down in rocks and floating high in the air. These findings show that life is tougher and more adaptive than had been assumed, and imply that life could exist on planets that had been thought to be too hot or cold. Jupiter's satellite Europa, for example, may have a global ocean and hot vents resembling the fertile founts found in Earth's seas. Meanwhile, astronomers have adduced evidence of planets orbiting stars near the Sun, confirming the long-held hypothesis that our galaxy contains billions of planets, some of which could be expected to have life, even if the advent of life is rare. Earth scientists are finding new evidence that life began here quite early on, adding fuel to the argument that biology arises in the normal course of things, at least on planets that resemble Earth. Astrophysical studies of nebulae in the Milky Way galaxy and beyond show that the basic ingredients of life as we know it are not unique to our quarter of the cosmos, but are widespread. Water, organic molecules, and sources of energy are found in countless locations, suggesting that the universe may have given birth to life in a literally unimaginable variety of environments. From such discoveries come new incentives to keep learning about our planet and its place in the wider universe. Such efforts are not forbiddingly expensive, as such things go. The United States in peacetime spends far more money each year on military applications in space than on manned and unmanned space exploration. Nonetheless, they are criticized by those who claim to have reasoned their way to the conclusion that there is no life, or at least none that is intelligent, out among the stars. These arguments are not wholly without merit. It's true that we have as yet no solid evidence that extraterrestrial life exists, and that dream-struck enthusiasts might want to keep searching even if we had one day scrutinized a million planets and found that all were sterile. The universe is so vast that we'd have hardly begun. Life might yet be found on the next planet or the one after that. But we know so little so far that to stop now would be at best premature. We tried not searching for more than 10,000 years. That didn't work. If science has taught us anything, certainly it is that one should never underestimate the scope of human ignorance and its influence on our commonplace ways of thinking. It may be that the search for life beyond Earth is more about exploration than science, but that hardly diminishes its stature. Exploration has been central to our success as a species, and to cease exploring is to risk becoming less than human. Certainly the potential rewards of finding life elsewhere would be substantial. Science, which thrives on comparison and seldom does well when studying something of which it has but a single example, would benefit immeasurably from knowledge of just a single species of extraterrestrial life with which to compare the one form of biology that we know about. And the influences that would be brought to bear on philosophy, theology, history, and art from the discovery of even an humble life form, much less an intelligent one, can scarcely be overestimated. Science sits at the center of our culture, which deserves to be told about its findings and its informed speculations. It was to this end that I agreed to write and narrate the 2-hour documentary film after which this book is titled, and from the script of which its words are taken. Such films are not textbooks designed to prepare their audiences to pass biology or astronomy exams, but they have a demonstrated ability to sensitize people to science and to involve them in the enterprise of scientific research, if only as informed generalists. Their aim is not so much to provide answers as to improve the quality of the questions we all ask whenever we wonder about how life and intelligence began, who we are, and where we came from. We are rank beginners in this quest, and as such we can reap the benefits of keeping an active imagination. As the Zen master Shinryu Suzuki put it, "In the beginner's mind there are many possibilities, but in the expert's there are few." To reflect on the wild diversity of life on this one planet, and not least on the rich diversity of individuals within our one species, is to consider how much we have not yet imagined, but can, perhaps, begin to learn. Part 1. Are We Alone? In the beginning. In the beginning, when all was fire, there were no stars or planets, no atoms or molecules, and no life. Eons passed and life appeared on at least one small planet orbiting an average star in a spiral galaxy called the Milky Way. On one planet, one species, endowed with the capacity to think and speak, has begun to wonder, did it happen only here? What follows is a report from a few members of that species on the search for life beyond Earth. All earthly life is kin. We're all members of the same ship's company, adrift on a planet that has nurtured life for almost 5 billion years. But while life is old, we humans are young. Since life on Earth began, the Sun and its planets have completed about a dozen orbits around the center of the Milky Way galaxy. But since humans came along, the solar system has wheeled less far than the second hand of a clock ticks off in a single second. So we're young. But we're also bright, or so we like to think. Of all the animals on Earth, we alone have the capacity to investigate how life began, to wonder where it might be headed, and to ask whether there are creatures on other planets who are asking the same kinds of questions. Our quest for life beyond Earth begins by searching the cosmos for the 3 things that terrestrial life requires: energy, water, and organic molecules, molecules that contain carbon, the basis of life. Scientists are now learning that all 3 ingredients are not unique to Earth, but are found throughout the universe. Most of the Earth's energy comes from the Sun, but the Sun is just one among 1 billion trillion stars. There's plenty of energy out there. Water is essential to life, as people have long appreciated. The Greek philosopher Thales portrayed water as the basis of all things. Confucius said, "The man of wisdom delights in water." Human beings are mostly water. The cells in our bodies are little bags of water and organic molecules. Astronomers have found evidence of water and organics in the solar system and beyond. Mercury, the planet closest to the Sun, has ice at its poles, as do the Moon and the planet Mars. The giant outer planets harbor organics, and many of their moons are covered in ice. Swarms of comets orbit the Sun. Each comet is an iceberg freighted with water and organics. New planets are forming in Orion and elsewhere from disks of rocks and ice surrounding newborn stars. These planets incorporate the water and organics in the clouds, while their central star bathes them in energy. The energy that sustains life can come from inside a planet as well. On geologically active planets like Earth, volcanoes pump water vapor and carbon compounds into the atmosphere, making them available to living organisms. Their veins of glowing lava are the life's blood of a thriving planet. Old volcanoes like Yellowstone, the largest volcano in the United States, are fountainheads of warmth and nourishment that link the geological activity below to the vitality of life above, on Earth and perhaps on other planets as well. From the center of the Earth to the far-flung galaxies, we find evidence that life arose from cosmic processes. The iron in our blood and the calcium in our bones were made inside stars. All the silver and gold on earth, from the vaults of Fort Knox to the wedding rings in the corner pawn shop, was forged by stars that exploded long ago, seeding with tons of diamonds and gold the interstellar clouds from which the sun and its planets later formed. Terrestrial life is embedded in a cosmic web, and it seems reasonable to speculate that life may be cosmically commonplace. Evolution. Once life arose on Earth, it evolved in unpredictable ways. Biological evolution is not a plodding climb from lower to higher forms. It's a wild improvisational dance, as its history reveals. We marked off 5 kilometers of road to represent the history of the Earth on a scale of 1 kilometer equals 1 billion years. The Earth formed about 0.5 kilometer down the road some 4.5 billion years ago, and the earliest fossil life forms yet identified on Earth date from 3.75 billion years ago. These early studies are sufficiently sophisticated to suggest that life had already been evolving for quite a while, but they don't exactly add up to Saturday night in the big city. For a very long time, the most complex forms of life on Earth were blobs of single-celled bacteria and algae called stromatolites. They may not look like much, indeed they look a bit like rocks, but they were the stars of the show for 3 billion years of evolution. That's 3 kilometers on down the highway. It would take a while to walk. We'd better drive. Even at 100 miles an hour, it takes a full minute to traverse the long, dull time during which life on Earth took few more complex forms than bacteria, algae, and plankton. And that's been the dynamic of evolution here on Earth, not a slow progression from so-called lower to higher life forms, but long periods of relative stasis followed by sudden bursts of innovation. The most dramatic burst of biological inventiveness came just over 0.5 billion years ago, when a whole array of creatures equipped with claws and teeth and tentacles appeared in what is aptly called the Cambrian Explosion. Its cause is something of a mystery, but the forms taken on by nearly all the organisms on Earth today represent variations on the plans invented during the Cambrian. The events that loom largest from our human perspective all lie along the very last stretch of highway. Mammals appeared 200 million years ago, just 200 meters from the end of the highway. Our distant ancestors learned how to walk upright a little under 4 million years ago, and the whole human story lies in the last half meter, easily overlooked on a nearly 5-kilometer-long highway through time. All recorded history, the rise and fall of empires, every innovation from the building of the pyramids to the invention of print, took place in the last few millimeters. And as for science, well, modern science came along so recently you'd need a microscope to see it. Never before has this planet hosted a species acute enough to find its place on the highway of time, to ask how life on Earth began, and to wonder whether life also has arisen on other planets. The search for life beyond Earth is the latest chapter in humanity's long history of exploring new lands and finding new varieties of life there. The islands of the Pacific were settled by navigators who steered by the stars across dark seas that must have seemed as vast as deep space. The circumnavigation of the globe by Magellan's ship Vitoria in the 16th century proved that the Earth is a sphere, unbounded but finite, capable of being mapped and fully explored. Scientific expeditions like the voyage of Captain James Cook to the South Pacific in 1769 had 3 missions, to map the Earth, to document the exotic life forms they found, and to help chart the realm of the other planets. In Tahiti, Cook and his crew observed a rare transit of Venus across the sun from a mountaintop site known ever since as Point Venus. They were taking part in an effort to measure the size of the solar system. By timing the moment when Venus first impinged on the solar disk as seen from Tahiti and from another location thousands of miles away, the distance from the Earth to the Sun could be measured through triangulation. The relative sizes of all the visible planets' orbits were already known, so once the size of Earth's orbit was established, that of the others would follow. The exploration of space had begun, with planet Earth its first destination. Wrote the artist Sidney Parkinson, who accompanied Cook and painted some of the exotic life forms they encountered in the South Pacific, How amazingly diversified are the works of the deity within the narrow limits of this globe we inhabit. As specimens were brought back to museums and scientific societies in Paris and London, it became clear that these newly discovered species of plants and animals were, for all their diversity, related, that they shared a common origin. But if the species are all related, how did they get to be so different? The brig HMS Beagle was a 19th-century spaceship dispatched on a round-the-world mission to investigate life on Earth. The naturalist aboard the Beagle, Charles Darwin, was young and inexperienced, fresh out of college, but he loved collecting plants and animals, and in studying them he became the first to realize how evolution works, by combining the creativity of random mutation with the editing power of natural selection to turn one species into many. Ever since Darwin, evolution has been the pole star of the biological sciences. Darwin's theory revealed that living things and the planets they live on all function under the same set of physical laws. As Darwin wrote, "There is grandeur in this view of life, with its several powers, having been originally breathed by the Creator into a few forms or into one, and that whilst this planet has gone cycling on according to the fixed law of gravity, from so simple a beginning, endless forms, most beautiful and most wonderful, have been and are being evolved." We don't know whether life on other planets would be based on DNA or some different molecule, but we do think it would evolve along Darwinian lines. The DNA molecule, the blueprint for life on Earth, contains a chemical code based on 4 polynucleotides that harbors all the genetic information necessary to reproduce the organism to which it belongs. That's a lot of information. A single sunflower seed has the data storage capacity of 100,000 books. It may seem amazing that all the millions of species of life could be encoded using just 4 chemical symbols, but actually 4 is more than enough. Life could have gotten by with as few as 2. This audiobook was digitally recorded using a code consisting of nothing but zeros and ones. We don't know whether extraterrestrial life forms would be based on DNA or some other molecular blueprint, but it's widely presumed that Darwinian selection is the way life works, not just here on Earth, but everywhere else that there is life. Critics of Darwin's theory say it's impossible to imagine creating birds or butterflies by randomly organizing 4 symbols, just as it's impossible to imagine that randomly organizing the letters of the alphabet could produce King Lear. And they're right so far as that argument goes, but it doesn't go very far. Evolution isn't just random chance, it's also a matter of discarding the variations that don't work and keeping the ones that do. The variations that have survived are the ones that have promoted survival, so DNA forms a kind of history library, a record of perseverance on a changing planet. By exploring the lands and seas, studying creatures alive today and the fossil records of those that lived in the past, scientists began to piece together the story of how life evolved. Theirs was a great contribution to human knowledge. But exploration is a two-way street, and what Europeans regarded as the discovery of new lands often seemed to those who already lived there like an assault from another planet. As Captain Cook put it, "How can these people see us as anything other than invaders of their territory?" Asked Pedro Pizin of the Doi people, Papua New Guinea, "The white man came from there. We'd never seen such a thing. How did he come from the ground? How did he come from the sky, the water? We were confused. We thought that these white men were lifted from the sky." The English author H.G. Wells noted that the so-called discovery of Tasmania by the Europeans was a very frightful disaster for the Tasmanians themselves. How would we feel, he wondered, if technologically advanced creatures from another planet colonized Earth? Wells's musings about the dark underbelly of colonialism resulted in the first modern science fiction novel, War of the Worlds. When Orson Welles broadcast a radio dramatization of H.G. Wells's novel, panic broke out among those listeners who took seriously the notion that the Earth was being invaded by an armada of hostile Martians. Soon the movie theaters and airwaves were alive with tales of death from above. In the public imagination, space had ceased to be cold and empty. It was a jungle out there, When humans actually ventured into space, the search for life was seldom very far from their minds. But where was life to be found? Our nearest neighbor, the airless moon, showed no signs of indigenous life, and rocks returned to Earth by the Apollo astronauts were sterile. Yet bacteria that were accidentally transported to the moon aboard an unmanned lunar lander evidently survived there for years. And so strong was the association of exploration with the search for life that when the Apollo astronauts returned to Earth, they were placed in quarantine just to be sure they hadn't picked up any moon germs. The habitable zone. More promising as abodes for life were the Earth's two neighboring planets, Venus and Mars. They orbit within what was called the habitable zone, close enough to the Sun for solar energy to drive the chemistry of life, but not so close as to boil off water or break down the organic molecules on which life depends. And it was thought they might have hot, molten cores that could power volcanoes like the ones that help sustain life here on Earth. Venus was a favorite of science fiction writers who imagined it to be a lush, tropical planet, a kind of celestial Tahiti. Perpetually shrouded in clouds, Venus was a mystery. Nobody knew what might be down there. The real Venus proved to be stranger than fiction. A series of unmanned Venera probes, dispatched by the Russians from 1966 to 1982, descended through the dense clouds and landed on the surface of Venus. They found not a lush jungle, but a dry, hellish world almost devoid of oxygen and hot enough to melt lead. Although the Venera probes were built sturdy as diving bells, each could take photos and obtain data for only about an hour before being destroyed by the heat and pressure. Scientists now theorize that Venus fell victim to a runaway greenhouse effect, excess carbon dioxide trapping solar heat under the blanket of its atmosphere. Many questions remain to be answered about Venus. Was its climate once more temperate than it is today, and if so, what went wrong? Was there ever life there in the past? David Grinspoon is a rock musician and an astronomer who works in comparative planetology, using what has been learned about other planets to enhance our understanding of Earth. As Grinspoon told us,
"The surface of Venus remained frustratingly hidden from us for hundreds of years. In the early 1990s, the Magellan spacecraft, an American spacecraft equipped with imaging radar, orbited and imaged the entire planet in stunning detail. All of a sudden, we went from almost no images of the surface of Venus, except for a few of those tantalizing Russian lander images, to a global view in very high resolution of the entire planet. Early telescopic observers of Venus correctly deduced that the fuzzy appearance of Venus in telescopic images is due to the fact that it's completely shrouded in clouds. Pretty recently, we started to get modern scientific data about the planet, which revealed the clouds to be made not of water, but of concentrated sulfuric acid, better known as battery acid. Venus is alive with volcanism. Other than the Earth, it's the most volcanically active planet in the inner solar system, and the range of styles of volcanism we see there is stunning. For instance, these pancake domes are made out of a very sticky kind of lava. That tells us that these are not made out of basalt. Basalt is very runny. This stuff, it's some kind of lava that's probably more rich in silica and less rich in iron and magnesium, and therefore doesn't flow as easily. One of the most surprising and controversial findings that we got from Magellan is that something radical changed relatively recently. About 500 million years ago, Venus essentially turned itself inside out with dramatic volcanic floods that covered up most of the previous surface features on the planet and probably flooded the air with greenhouse gases, causing rapid change to the climate as well as to the surface. This has perhaps disturbing implications because it tells us that Earth-like planets can undergo dramatic changes in both their surfaces and their climates in a relatively recent geologic epoch. And this information could mean that the Earth may have future threatening changes of this magnitude in store for us.
Mars was the planet thought most likely to harbor life. It lies within the habitable zone. and its polar cap suggested even to early observers that there could be water there. The amateur astronomer Percival Lowell of the Boston Lowells thought he saw canals on Mars. He built an observatory to study them and speculated that they had been constructed by a parched Martian civilization to ferry scarce water from the polar ice caps to their thirsty cities. But the canals turned out to be an optical illusion produced by the brain's tendency to connect dots to form lines. The actual search for life on Mars would require taking a closer look. A pair of instrumented Viking space probes were sent to Mars looking for signs of life. Each dispatched a lander to the surface, and in the pre-dawn hours of July 20, 1976, at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Southern California, scientists and spectators waited anxiously for humankind's first close-up look at the surface of Mars. What the pictures revealed was neither any obvious sign of life nor a landscape as desolate as that of Venus, but a different sort of world with a character and history all its own. The landers dug up Martian soil and tested it for signs of biological activity. The tests found some unexpected chemical reactions, but no clear evidence of life. Meanwhile, a pair of Viking orbiters took images that showed dry riverbeds, indicating that Mars once had liquid water on its surface, and therefore had a denser atmosphere, perhaps one sufficient to support life. Viking confirmed that Mars, like Venus and Earth, has volcanoes. The largest, Olympus Mons, is the biggest volcano in the solar system, but the very fact that Olympus Mons is so big suggests that Mars is geologically dead. Earth's molten core drives plate tectonics. The plates that support continents and the ocean floor slowly drift, gigantic barges afloat on liquid stone. The volcanoes of Hawaii were built one after another from a single hotspot below. The motion of the surface plates carried each volcano away, rendering it extinct and leaving the hotspot to build another mountain in its wake. Mauna Kea, two-thirds the height of Olympus Mons, is the most recently completed of these colossal construction projects, but Mauna Kea has since moved off the hotspot and will grow no more. Meanwhile, the hotspot is building a new volcano to the south, adding fresh real estate to the island of Hawaii. And yet another is forming on the ocean floor, destined perhaps to become a Hawaiian island of the future. But on Mars, Olympus Mons stayed put and grew to great height, indicating that the core of Mars wasn't hot enough to move the surface plates around. The extinct volcanoes of Mars are geological gravestones. 20 years after Viking, another probe landed on Mars. Pathfinder touched down in a dry river delta and examined rocks carried there from the highlands in the days when Mars had rivers and streams. Again, no signs of life were found. Long ago, it seems, something went terribly wrong on Mars. The rivers and streams evaporated or froze into the ground, the atmosphere thinned out, and the planet's ozone layer, if it ever had one, collapsed, exposing the surface to sterilizing solar ultraviolet light. The possibility remains, though, that life got started before this disaster occurred. If so, did it die out and leave fossils, or might life still be there, patiently hibernating in the rusty sands of Mars? The fact that life isn't conspicuous doesn't mean it's not there. There are dry valleys in Antarctica as desolate-looking as the landscapes of Mars. When the explorer Robert Scott discovered one such valley in 1903, he wrote that, "We have seen no sign of life, not even a moss or a lichen." Yet there is life there, slowly growing microorganisms huddled in the frosty soil of Antarctica. Also to be found in the snows of the Antarctic are pieces of Mars, rocks knocked off the red planet that later fell to Earth. About a dozen such Mars meteorites have been recovered, and in one of them, researchers found what they considered to be fossils of Martian life. The evidence is preliminary at best, but it renewed interest in the tantalizing possibility that living organisms could have traveled around the early solar system, ferried aboard rocks that were blown off one planet and wound up on another. The origin of life. One way to investigate the origin of life is to look for places on Earth today where conditions approximate those that pertained back when life began. But where did life begin? On the ocean floor? On the surface, in volcanic hot springs, in tidal pools, with the first stirrings of evolution prompted perhaps by the rising and falling of tides, authored by the then-nearby moon? Or in volcanic hot springs, whether up top or on the ocean floor? And how did life begin? To find out, scientists are investigating the physics and chemistry of the early solar system. The Sun's planets formed like slag heaps when boulders and gravel orbiting the Sun were gathered together by gravitational attraction. Terrestrial life got started so early that the Earth was still being bombarded by cosmic debris when life began. The infant Earth was a violent place, its atmosphere a strange brew of methane and ammonia. Life has since refashioned the planet, making it more hospitable. And that's one of the problems about investigating how life originated. One has to think of the Earth not as it is now, but as it was then. Information stored in the genes of living creatures today suggests that life evolved from a single heat-loving ancestor, an organism that could cope with the volcanoes, sulfuric geysers, and meteorite storms of the early days. To learn what that ancestor was could bring us closer to understanding the origin of life. The heat-loving bacteria found in hot springs are among the oldest organisms on Earth, a clue that the earliest terrestrial life may have been nourished by the heat not of the sun, but of thermal vents generated by the Earth's molten core. Black smokers, as they're called, are hot, volcanic vents on the ocean floor. They host a rich variety of living organisms that get along in the darkness, sustained by geothermal energy. Other creatures like it cold. On the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico, researchers were startled to find worms living embedded in methane ice. The Ice Zone. The discovery that life can thrive in icy cold and hellish heat means that life need not have begun in a sunny, placid pond, as some had imagined, but might have arisen in the eternal night of the ocean depths, on Earth or any other world that has oceans and a molten core, no matter how far it is from the sun. So the habitable zone may be larger than anyone had realized. If the hot cores of geologically active worlds can sustain life in darkness, life could exist even among the icy outer planets where sunlight is weak. Jupiter, 5 times farther from the Sun than the Earth is, receives only 1/25th as much sunlight. So Jupiter's satellites are cold, at least on the outside. Yet the icy surface of Jupiter's satellite Europa is marked by lanky fissures, cracks that suggest the presence of an ocean below that warms and replenishes the ice. Europa may have a molten core that keeps the ocean from freezing, and that could power life-sustaining deep-sea vents like black smokers here on Earth. We could find out by dispatching a lander to melt a hole in the ice and drop a submarine into the European Sea. The automated submarine could roam Europa's ocean for years, searching for signs of life. Farther out in the solar system are other icy moons that are cold on the outside but maybe hot inside. Among them, Neptune's satellite Triton, and Saturn's satellite Enceladus. By sending probes to these mysterious moons, scientists can both search for life and study the primitive environments in which life arises. On Titan, the largest satellite of Saturn, a gentle rain of organic molecules is thought to fall amid conditions resembling those of the early Earth. A probe dispatched by the unmanned Cassini mission to Saturn was designed to search for clues to life's origins hidden beneath Titan's clouds. Jupiter's moon Io is a palpitating bag of lava. Scores of volcanoes pierce its grape-skin-thin surface. The Voyager spacecraft imaged a volcanic plume shooting into space from Io, and so decades later did the Galileo probe. 2 images made of the same spot on Io show a Texas-sized black splotch of volcanic eruption that wasn't there when the first photo was taken just 5 months earlier. Observations like these reveal that the geology of a volatile world like Io can be almost as changeable as the weather on Earth. The potential expansion of the habitable zone here in the solar system implies that life might thrive in other places that had been thought to be uninhabitable. There could be living creatures afloat in the atmospheres of gaseous planets like Jupiter. There could be life on young planets still entangled in the dark clouds from which they formed, or conceivably adrift in the clouds themselves, on internally heated planets beset by the winds of unstable suns, or on the freshly minted planets of hot young stars, on the ancient planets of old, steadily burning stars in globular clusters, or amid the fiery star-forming regions of colliding galaxies. There could be more life out there than we've ever imagined, for if the universe has taught us anything, it is that reality is richer and more resourceful than our wildest dreams. Terraforming. Life isn't fragile, it's tough. Here on Earth, life has endured heat, cold, and cataclysm, has emerged from the sea to inhabit the land and the air, and in human form has touched the moon. Someday we might carry the torch of life still farther outward to find a home on the planet Mars. If Mars proves to be sterile, we could make it suitable for life by transforming its environment through a global engineering project called terraforming. Terraforming Mars would mean providing the red planet with life's three requisites: water, energy, and organic molecules. There's some water there already, and human technology could provide the organics and boost the amount of available energy. In one plan, giant mirrors in space would warm the surface while genetically engineered plants and trees replenish the atmosphere. Eventually, the air would become breathable, and the great-great-grandchildren of the first colonists might fish and farm under the blue skies of a terraformed Mars. We humans once imagined that we were at the center of it all. Science has let the wind out of that vain claim. Cosmic maps show that we live closer to the edge than to the center of the galaxy, and genetic maps show us occupying the tip of just one branch of what's being called the shrub of life. We're not at the center of the universe, we're not at the top of the tree, but then neither is anyone else. And we're home, we're part of the universe. Yet we're also somehow apart from the universe, able to stand back and regard it objectively as intelligent observers. What does it mean to be intelligent, and how did intelligence originate here on Earth? Are there intelligent beings out among the stars? Will we ever be able to communicate with them, and if so, what would we say? Part 2. Is anybody listening? Visitors. Ours is a restless species, and in our wanderlust we have explored the globe and sent probes to look for life on some of the sun's other planets. But we're also a communicative species, and the way to search for life on the trillions of planets circling other suns may be through communication, if there are intelligent beings out there who want to communicate. If someday our descendants have explored the solar system as our predecessors explored the Earth, might they then venture onto the stars and set foot on the soil of an extrasolar planet? Can we sail through interstellar space as the mariners of old explored the islands of the sea? Or is it better to communicate by listening for messages from space and sending messages of our own? Any way you look at it, interstellar spaceflight is a daunting prospect. It's pretty roomy out there. If we could shrink the sun to the size of a single grain of salt, the Earth would be a microscopic grain orbiting at a distance of 1 inch, and the orbit of the planet Mars would lie within the palm of your hand. The whole solar system, the entire theater of wished-for human exploration for centuries to come, could be encompassed within the reach of your arms. Yet even on this tiny scale, the very nearest star would be more than 4 miles away, beyond the horizon. A futuristic starship might make the trip one day if we could figure out how to pay its titanic fuel bill and how to fire up its engines without frying the Earth in its exhaust, but interstellar spaceflight is likely to be expensive and slow. But if there are intelligent beings out there on the planets of other suns, we may be able to communicate with them even if they're too far away for us to visit them. Our own boldest explorations remind us that the stars are far away. The twin Voyager interstellar probes, launched in 1977, surveyed the giant outer planets and are now leaving the solar system. They carry a message, a gold-plated phonograph record containing music and sounds of Earth for the benefit of any aliens who might one day intercept the space probes. Although the Voyagers fly 50 times faster than a jet fighter, they will take 70,000 years to reach another star. Ever since the Renaissance, when Galileo established that other planets exist, people have imagined that we would one day explore deep space. The astronomer Johannes Kepler wrote to Galileo that given the right ships and the right sails for space, there will be men who are not afraid of the terrible distances. Actually, the right ships already existed in embryonic form. Rockets began as a form of entertainment for the Chinese, who turned them into weapons of defense against the Mongols. The Italians turned them back into fireworks. By the second half of the 20th century, rockets were being launched that were powerful enough to carry people aloft. In a series of steps potentially as profound as the migration of life from the seas onto dry land, humans ventured into space. The advent of space flight lent new immediacy to an old question. If we can travel beyond our planet, couldn't the denizens of other planets come here, or be here already? Anyone who spends a lot of time looking at the night sky is likely sooner or later to see something he can't identify. I've seen a few myself. My most impressive sighting was of a V-shaped formation of white lights that moved through the sky silently at what seemed to be an incredibly high speed. Fortunately, I had a pair of binoculars around my neck, so I was able to get a closer look. And you know what they turned out to be? Birds. A flock of migrating birds, lights from a distant city lighting up their bellies to make perfect little oval flying saucers. If I hadn't had the binoculars handy, it would have been a mysterious UFO sighting. The question isn't just what we see, but how we interpret it. To claim that lights in the sky are alien invaders is like claiming that they're angels. It explains everything, and therefore it explains nothing. If we can hold off judgment until we have better information, we can distinguish more often between dubious and sound propositions and between birds and spaceships. When a real flying object unexpectedly shows up, like the bright meteor that crossed the western part of North America on the afternoon of August 10, 1972, or the one that passed over New York State on a Friday night in the fall of 1992, it typically results in much better pictures and more consistent eyewitness reports than has any alleged UFO sighting. And yet millions of people still believe that UFOs are alien spaceships. Why? Perhaps because we tend to project our deepest hopes and fears onto the sky, imagining that the aliens are warlike and dangerous, or that they're angelic benefactors who've come to save us from ourselves. In the classic 1951 science fiction film The Day the Earth Stood Still, Klaatu says, "Your choice is simple. Join us and live in peace, or pursue your present course and face obliteration. We shall be waiting for your answer. The decision rests with you." The Infosphere. No one has come to rescue us, and it's unlikely that anyone will show up soon. And that fact may be telling us something, that the best way to get in touch with intelligent extraterrestrials is not exploration, but communication, by sending not starships, but electronic signals across the interstellar seas. The idea of communicating with extraterrestrials has been in the air since at least the 19th century, when scientists suggested that we signal the Martians on a night when Mars passes near the Earth. Their proposal was to dig a giant triangle in Siberia, flood it with kerosene, and set the trenches afire. The Martians would recognize the triangle as a symbol of Euclidean geometry, a sure sign of intelligent life on Earth. In a modern version of the flaming triangle, the Chinese artist Cai Guo Zhang ignited a 10,000-meter-long gunpowder fuse extended from one end of the Great Wall of China. He called the installation Project for Extraterrestrials. Cai's work reinvents the partnership of fireworks and exploration, but for sending real messages through space, radio communication works better. Radio can carry words, numbers, and pictures cheaply and at the velocity of light. The almost miraculous speed with which radio carries messages prompted even the earliest pioneers of radio technology to imagine using this wonderful new device to communicate with other worlds. Guglielmo Marconi, inventor of radio, picked up what he thought might be radio pulses from space, and Nikola Tesla claimed that he too had received extraterrestrial signals. Tesla generated powerful electrical bursts at his laboratory in Colorado Springs and fancied that the resulting radio noise could be received on other planets. These imagined receptions were replaced by the real thing in 1931, when a Bell Telephone Company engineer named Carl Jansky accidentally detected the radio energy emitted naturally by clouds of hydrogen gas in the Milky Way. Grote Reber, an amateur radio enthusiast, then built the world's first true radio telescope, a metal dish 31 feet in diameter in the backyard of his home in Wheaton, Illinois, and used it to map the Milky Way. Today, radio telescopes record the murmur of interstellar gas clouds, the pulses of rapidly spinning neutron stars, and the screams of colliding galaxies. Earth has been inadvertently broadcasting to the stars for decades. The television premiere of Life Beyond Earth was one such broadcast. It reached the planet Saturn in an hour and a half and continued into deep space. A sphere of radio and television broadcasts surrounds our planet. Its radius is nearly 100 light years, and it's expanding at the speed of light. 1,000 stars lie within the sphere of radio and TV broadcasts that have leaked into space from Earth. If there are any listeners out there, they could, in theory, intercept these broadcasts. The farther they are from us, the older the news they're receiving. Alpha Centauri is a star only 4 light years away, so Earth's broadcasts reaching Alpha Centauri today are only 4 years old. The star Capella is 40 light years away. If anyone's listening there, what they're hearing from Earth are the hits of the 50s. The golden age of jazz is just dawning at Beta Pictoris, a star that shows evidence of having planets forming around it. Any radio buffs at Mizar, a star in the handle of the Big Dipper, are in a position just about now to be picking up Earth's very first broadcasts. We're leaking radio messages into space, and the inhabitants of other planets, if they exist, might be doing the same thing. Large radio telescopes on Earth could detect such radio leaks from civilizations in nearby star systems, as well as stronger signals dispatched intentionally by planets thousands of light years away. This realization is the keystone of SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Some scientists doubt that there are any intelligent beings out there. One of their arguments is called Fermi's question. It's named for the Italian physicist Enrico Fermi, who asked, "Where are they?" His point was that technologically advanced aliens, if they exist, should have visited Earth already. Since they evidently have not, they don't exist. I performed an experiment to test the validity of Fermi's question. At home alone one night, I decided to have lobster for dinner. So I set a place, opened the door to the street, and waited for a lobster to show up and crawl onto my plate. Hours passed. At 11 p.m., I ended the experiment. No lobster had appeared, so I concluded there are no lobster on Earth. Since we know that lobster do exist, clearly there was something wrong with my reasoning. The error was, of course, that I'd failed to take the lobster's preferences into account. Lobster have their own agenda. They don't want to come to my house. But the fact that they don't show up doesn't mean they don't exist. As the SETI scientists like to say, absence of evidence isn't evidence of absence. Suppose we had an atlas that devoted but one page to each planet in the Milky Way galaxy. That's a lot of planets. To page just once through all the volumes of this atlas, glancing at one planet per second, day and night, would take over 10,000 years. As the historian Thomas Carlyle said, contemplating the prospect of billions of worlds, if they be inhabited, what a scope for misery and folly. If they not be inhabited, what a waste of space. At astronomical observatories like Keck on the island of Hawaii, astronomers are finding evidence of planets orbiting nearby stars. Astronomer Paul Butler says,
"We only want to know two things. What fraction of stars have planets, and what fraction of those planetary systems are similar to our own solar system?" It wasn't until the early part of this century that it even became technically feasible to begin looking for planets around other stars.
Astronomer Jeffrey Marcy says,
Our technique involves watching a star to see how it is gravitationally pulled by its attendant planets. And an Earth-like planet is simply too small to yank around its host star. But a Jupiter, being some 300 times more massive than an Earth-like planet, does have enough gravitational oomph to yank its star around. And so for the moment, all we can detect are Jupiters and maybe Saturn-like planets. We watch the star night after night, month after month, and if the star does wobble, it must be doing so because a planet is pulling on it. It's a little bit like a dog owner having a little poodle on the end of a leash. The poodle, being very low mass, can still yank its owner around if the poodle goes around in circles. And in this case, the low mass planets can yank around the star. In the case of a poodle, of course, the leash is this leather tether. In the case of the planets, the leash is gravity.
We look for very teeny shifts in the spectrum that tell us that, in fact, the star is wobbling in space. It is moving alternately towards us and away from us. If the star is moving towards you, its entire spectrum will be shifted to the blue, and if the star is moving away from you, then the star will be shifted to the red.
Future telescopes operating in space could be linked together to create the equivalent of a lens larger than the Earth. Such orbiting observatories might be able to detect signs of life on the planets of nearby stars. Telescopes have incited speculation about extraterrestrial life ever since the summer night 400 years ago when Galileo first trained a telescope on the sky. Galileo called the universe a great book written in the characters of geometrical figures. This was a revolutionary idea. The books that mattered in Galileo's day were the ones written by ancient authorities like Aristotle and Ptolemy. They said that the universe was a kind of nutshell with the Earth at its center, and that the sun and planets were ethereal wafers pasted on the inside of the shell. In that kind of universe, there could be no life on other worlds because there were no other worlds. The stars and planets were like the decorations on the insides of the great cathedrals, beautiful, pristine, nearby, and useless. But when Galileo turned a telescope on the sky, he found that the planets and the moon don't look like wafers. They look like rotund worlds, resembling the Earth in some ways. And when he looked at the sun, he found that it wasn't perfect, but was besmirched by sunspots. As Galileo observed the sun in Florence week after week, he could see the sunspots, which are giant magnetic storms on the surface of the sun, moving across the solar disk. Not the behavior of a flat, static object, but, as we would say today, of a rotating ball of plasma, a star. Galileo's observations blew the roof off the universe. Aristotle, to the contrary, the Earth is not the only world bounded in a starry nutshell. It's one among many worlds, and there's no nutshell at all. The sun is a star, and every star is a sun. The mathematical laws of nature that pertain here on Earth work everywhere else as well. So if there's life here, why not out there? Galileo's experiments touched off a scientific revolution that awakened humankind to the possibility of life beyond Earth. In Germany, Johannes Kepler identified the laws that govern the motion of the planets. Kepler found that planets move faster when close to the sun and slower when farther away, in just such a way that their orbits always sweep out equal areas in equal times. This is a genuinely universal law, true of any object in orbit, from the moons of Jupiter to the planets of distant stars. In England, Isaac Newton showed that Kepler's laws result from the force of gravitation exerted by the Earth and every other massive object. It is by using Newton's equations that today's space navigators are able to put probes into orbit around Venus, Mars, and Jupiter. In the 20th century, Albert Einstein cleared up disparities in Newton's theory by composing a broader account of gravitation, his general theory of relativity. Relativity implied that cosmic space is expanding. The idea seemed so outlandish that Einstein himself rejected it. But big new telescopes were being built, and astronomers using them were able to identify individual stars in other galaxies and determine that they obey the same physical laws that pertain here on Earth. In 1929, the American astronomer Edwin Hubble, without knowing that relativity implied that the universe expands, discovered that the distant galaxies are indeed moving apart from one another, just as Einstein's theory had predicted. 4 centuries after Galileo, humans had learned that the universe is all of a piece, expanding and evolving in accordance with one set of physical laws. Living creatures are made of the same stuff as are the stars and planets, and they obey the same laws, and so, in theory, life could exist all over the universe. Message in a bottle. There are more stars in the universe than there are grains of sand at the seashore. Our human desire to communicate runs so deep that we're willing to send messages even though we're not sure who might receive them. Today we have the means to send messages to the planets of other stars, but would anyone be listening? If we are to communicate with the inhabitants of other worlds, there must be creatures out there who have language, radio technology, and the ability to keep transmitting for centuries at a time so that their signals can cross hundreds of light years of interstellar space. Yet we don't know how we learn to use language, or how long we may be willing and able to listen for messages from the stars. If we understood how intelligence arose on Earth, we'd have a better idea of how intelligence arises on other planets. The size of our ancestors' brains more than doubled during the past 2 million years, but nobody knows quite why. Somewhere along the line, about 50,000 years ago, human speech advanced from grunts and warning cries to the use of words as abstractions, capable of probing beyond the realm of immediate experience. In much the same way that prehistoric painters brought the daylit world into the darkness of caves, ancient poets painted word pictures of events remote in space and time. From that point on, evolution began to select not just for brute force and endurance, but for abstract intelligence as well. Nobody knows just when this happened or how. Until we do, it's going to be difficult to estimate how often intelligence may have arisen on other planets. But once our ancestors could make sentences, they could make plans. In hunting and warfare, the balance began to shift from strength to strategy, with strategy tending to win out in the end. As Abraham Lincoln put it, force is all conquering, but its victories are short-lived. Language is the key to communication. Symbolic language enables us to do mathematics, describe events that happened far away, and make a lasting record of our thoughts and feelings. If we are to communicate with extraterrestrials, they too must be able to manipulate symbols. To search for intelligent life in the universe is, therefore, to search for another species similarly endowed with an aptitude for symbolic language. If they don't have language, they may be smart, but we're not apt to hear from them. Creatures lacking symbolic language cannot send complex messages through space or much of anywhere else. They can cry out in alarm or coo tenderly to their young, but they can't tell someone far away about their planet, their history, or their science. Indeed, without language, they can't have any real history or science. In that sense, looking for intelligent extraterrestrials means looking for beings rather like ourselves. Not that they'd resemble us physically or speak in a human tongue, but they would, by definition, have language. And where there is language, there is hope for translation, and in translation, an end to the long twilight of human loneliness, during which we have known the delights and torments of being uniquely thoughtful, communicative, and self-aware. Is intelligent life merely an accident? Popular accounts of science sometimes say so, claiming that life and intelligence are trivial. One scientist called life a fancy kind of rust afflicting the surfaces of certain lukewarm minor planets. Another portrayed humans as scum, a cosmic afterthought clinging to a small planet in an uncaring universe. But there's a new vision on the horizon, one that sees intelligence as what is called an emergent property, apt to appear on any planet that has a sufficiently complex biological system. The patterns formed by birds in flight and by schools of fish are emergent properties. They can be seen not in individual fish or birds, but only in large assemblages of them. According to this theory, emergent properties can be understood only by studying the system as a whole. The spiral arms of galaxies are fireworks shows created when brilliant young stars are formed by density waves moving across the galactic disk. Millions of stars must be born for the spiral pattern to appear. Weather is an emergent property. A low-pressure front is made of molecules of air and water, but we cannot perceive it just by looking at individual molecules. Only when we consider the system at large does it emerge as a thunderstorm. If intelligence emerges normally in the biospheres of living planets, as naturally as weather patterns emerge in their atmospheres, there may be many thinking beings on other worlds. Science traditionally has concentrated on the parts, the approach known as reductionism. But if intelligence is an emergent property, arising as naturally as clouds gathering to make a storm, then thought may not be incidental to the workings of the universe, but in some sense the point of it all, the central theme in a cosmic symphony. Destiny. There's an Islamic saying that three things are known to no man: the hour of his death, the true name of Allah, and the source of his next meal. In the Jewish tradition, there's the story of a rabbi who's stopped after curfew by a Cossack who says, "Where are you going, old man?" and answers, "I don't know." The Cossack arrests him, and as the door to his cell slams shut, the rabbi says, "You see, I told you I didn't know where I was going." Which is pretty much our situation as members of an intelligent species who don't know if there are any other intelligent beings out there in the universe. We think it's good to be smart, that it bodes well for our destiny, and should for other species, too, in other worlds. But we don't really know where we're going, do we? Does the fact that humans are intelligent mean that we're likely to survive, or will we blow ourselves up or pollute the Earth so badly that we can no longer live here? The physicist Richard Gott has devised a formula for predicting how long the human species is going to last. He begins with the assumption that there's a 95% likelihood that we're living during the middle 95% of humanity's total tenure. To date, Homo sapiens have existed for about 200,000 years. So, says Gott, there's a 95% chance that you're located in the middle 95% of human history, and that, therefore, the future longevity of the human race is likely to be longer than 150 years, but less than 7.8 million years. Now, those numbers are interesting because they give us a total longevity that's quite similar to that of other species. All beings who have learned that the universe is old must also know that by comparison they are young. The longer alien civilizations typically last, the better our chances of communicating with them. Imagine that the lights on a Christmas tree represent technological civilizations that might have arisen in a given galaxy over a given period of, say, 1 million years. And that the length of time that each light stays on represents the period during which each civilization is willing and able to make radio contact with the inhabitants of other such worlds. If the communicative worlds typically stay on the air for 500,000 years, their persistence is rewarded. Each will find that it has plenty of contemporaries with whom to make radio contact. So if civilizations last a long time, SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, is a cinch. But what happens if alien civilizations typically last only 100,000 years before they become extinct or lose interest? Now the blinking bulbs on our Christmas tree blink for a shorter period of time, and we find that there are only a few worlds on the air at any given time. What monuments might they have built to leave some trace of themselves in the annals of cosmic history? Perhaps they long ago established a permanent network to link inhabited planets and preserve a record of their histories. If so, the first signal we receive could come from an interstellar internet. Deployed over eons by robotic spacecraft, such a network could bring libraries of information within relatively close reach of emerging worlds like ours. Communication can bridge time as well as space, revealing the histories of societies that disappeared long ago and offering clues to how our species might best navigate its way toward the dim and distant future. We don't know how many alien civilizations exist or how long they typically last, or how many of them take the trouble to broadcast signals. What if everybody's listening and nobody's sending? Scientists involved in SETI seldom transmit anything, either because they'd have to wait decades or centuries to get an answer, or out of fear of betraying our presence to aliens who might, for all we know, be hostile toward us. But what if someday we want to send a message, a powerful message, beamed to a planet where we had some reason to expect that there was someone listening? What would we say? The astrophysicist Franz Cordova would ask, I want to know if they're bad guys or good guys. If they're good, we can work with them, right? The physicist Paul Horowitz would send this message, Dear extraterrestrial, please respond to this message by sending a radio signal back on the frequency at which you receive this message, making due allowance, of course, for your motions around your star. Send that signal at a power level such that it arrives on Earth with at least 10 to the minus 23rd watts per square meter, and leave your transmitter running long enough, let's say a few months, so that one of the searches now operating on Earth will receive it. Then we can really get a conversation going. The physicist Freeman Dyson would say,
Please forgive us for making so much noise. You know, but talking is what we do all the time, and maybe the reason we don't hear the aliens is because they are different, and they keep quiet.
The paleontologist Stephen J. Gould says,
What I want to know from you is, what's your biochemistry? I really want to know whether life has to be done through DNA or whether there are lots of other ways, and I need another experiment to find out. And the other thing, I will give to you the B minor mass, because that's the best thing we've ever done. But I'd like to know whether you've ever done anything that beautiful, and if so, what was it, and share it with us.
Physicist Richard Gott's message is,
Our intelligent species has been around for 200,000 years, and we have sent members of our species to our neighboring moon. And we've learned something of the laws of physics, and we've learned where we are in the universe. How are you doing?
My message to the aliens goes as follows. Greetings from one of the species that inhabit Earth, a blue planet orbiting an average star. We call ourselves Homo sapiens, by which we mean that we are capable of mathematics, science, and the technology by which this message is being sent. We're the only such creatures on this world, and so far as we know, the only ones to have lived here throughout its long history. Science has brought a better life for millions of us, but many more of us still live in poverty, tyranny, and ignorance. Sometimes we wonder if there is intelligent life on Earth. We've only just glimpsed the vastness of time and space and of our own ignorance. We've learned that we have a lot to learn. And so we're dispatching this message in hopes of learning something about you and about ourselves. We request the favor of a reply.
Copyright New Millennium Audio, 2000. A division of NM World Media, Inc.